Let's bring in Edward Lucas, international editor for The Economist, also former Moscow bureau chief for that magazine. He's in the Economist studios in London. Edward, as we said at the start today, the Russian foreign minister said President Assad is open to dialogue with dissidents like Danny. And we just heard Danny say, no, they don't want to negotiate. Your thoughts?
I'm very skeptical of the idea that the Assad regime is suddenly, literally, the road to Damascus, conversion on the road to Damascus. I think the way in which they make decisions is very paranoid and introverted, and they feel that the only way out for them is either victory, in which they crush the opposition the way they've crushed uprisings in the past, or it's death, where they end up like Gaddafi, really shot in a drain in a ditch somewhere. And I think there's a chance of trying to broker some kind of dignified withdrawal, but I think it's a fairly small one, and I'm rather skeptical that Russia's in a position to do it.
Yeah, well, and we're hearing BBC reports that Russia is, in fact, also gently nudging its ally Syria to consider reforms. But I just, the human aspect for a second, because we just, it's always so good, you know, here we're hearing somebody hunkered down in their home, in homes. It's hard to imagine what will happen to Danny and others if Homs falls to government troops.
Well, they'll all be killed and the city will be flattened. And this is what this regime did it. Bashar Assad's father, Assad Sr., did that with Hama. And the reports are between 20,000 killed, maybe more. So this regime has an extraordinary capacity to violent for violence, which it's displayed in the past. And I think it's absolutely listening to that account, particularly when you think that the world is in a position to do something. This is a terribly unfair fight. They have rifles and maybe Molotov cocktails to fight against tanks and heavy artillery. And I suspect that there probably are some weapons making their way via Turkey, perhaps thanks to Qatari sponsorship, but there's certainly room to do more. And I think the other very important psychological front is to try and make the regime see how isolated it is. And it's very good news that some Arab countries have been closing the Syrian embassy, expelling the Syrian diplomats, and giving the regime a feeling that that the ground's shifting away from it. And I think the more of that happens, the better, actually, because it will increase the leverage that might possibly lead to a negotiated solution.
Well, and today we heard the Gulf Cooperation Council, which includes Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, also joining the voices saying, you know, something's got to happen in Syria. But, you know, I guess the question is, will Syria go the way of Libya with insurgents taking up even more arms and maybe with an assist in the air from NATO taking down Assad? Or will it go the way of Iran, you know, where protesters are violently put down? Or is there another question?
I think history doesn't repeat itself, although it does sometimes rhyme. And I think the great danger in Syria, which is perhaps a greater danger than we had in Libya, is of a kind of outcome where you get the bad guy goes, but then you get a descent into sectarian violence. And Syria is, if anything, more combustible than Iraq was, with the Alawites, who are the religious sort of minority Islam Muslim group that from which President Assad draws most of his support, feeling that they're under threat from the Sunni minority, and many Sunnis perhaps wanting to get revenge on them. Then Christians and Druze and others all. So there's an all-out civil war will be disastrous, which makes it all the more important to try and get a negotiated solution. But I think that the key thing is whether the Arab League and Turkey, which I think are the countries that are in a position to do something, will actually do it. And the sight of Turkish planes flying overhead, I think, would be tremendously demoralising for the regime. They only really have two really effective military units. Much 100% Alawite. Other than that, their soldiers tend to defect or run away or not fight properly. So if one can apply pressure to those units and to the leadership, I think there is the chance of some give.
We're speaking to Edward Lucas of The Economist magazine. He's there in their studios in London. I just have to say there's been a slight breakup every now and then, so we apologize for that. But you were well worth listening to, despite that. And I just, before we take a break, we want to, you know, scan the international horizon with you at a time when there are several hot spots. But we're talking about Russia being in Syria today, Russia supplying Syria with some of these tanks that are now attacking Homs. Just, you know, very briefly, your thoughts on that connection, the Russian-Syrian axis?
Well, Syria is a major customer for Russian weapons, and the Russian arms industry is politically quite important. And Syria is also home to Russia's only base outside the former Soviet Union, although it's a pretty pathetic base. It's a naval base for a country that effectively doesn't have a navy anymore. But I think the key thing for Russia is that they see the Arab Spring as part of a pattern in which the West topples, doesn't like, and installs regimes that it does. And the West, they feel the West always says this is a one-off, and then it isn't. We said that Iraq was a one-off, Afghanistan was a one-off, Libya was, and now Syria. So although that's a very distorted way of viewing it, they see this as a road that would lead to regime change in Moscow, and they don't like that.
Yeah. Edward Lucas, international editor for The Economist, whose brain we like to pick about international hotspots on occasion, and now is the time to do it. Edward, we've been talking about Russia being in Syria today, Russia and Syria allies, but just before we move on to Israel, Iran, I just want to ask you, you were Moscow bureau chief for The Economist, and we saw these protests this past weekend against Vladimir Putin running for another presidential term. Where do you think that's going?
I think that the Putin regime has lost a lot of legitimacy in the last few weeks. It hasn't actually lost power, and I think one has to reckon it's pretty likely he's going to win, almost certainly on the first round, just possibly on the second round, the first round being on March the 4th. The big problem for him is what do you do after that, because what's really changed is that Putin really looks ridiculous now in the eyes of many Russians. It's quite extraordinary if you go on the internet and just go to YouTube and look for videos about Putin. There's a new, very funny, savage parody coming up almost every day. And that just didn't happen a year or so ago. He can't appear in public without being booed or whistled.
Isn't that something? I mean, how are you, you know, a longtime observer of the region? How weird is that to you?
It's very, I mean, in a way, it's very overdue that I've been a critic of Mr. Putin since he first became prime minister back in 1999. I've never liked the KGB and had plenty of experience of them during the Soviet Union. And I didn't like the idea of an ex-KGB guy running Russia. But he benefited for a long time of A, not being Yeltsin and this not being the 1990s. So he met the hunger for stability and prosperity. And he also played on anti-Westernism and terrorism and on the idea that he was modernizing Russia. And all these big strong points he had are falling apart now. The country hasn't modernized. The anti-Westernism has worn off. People have forgotten the 1990s. And instead, people are really fed up with corruption and incompetence and this kind of cult of personality around him. And so I think that the big question is, once he gets back into the Kremlin, what's he do then? And I think it's inconceivable he would last for another 12 years. I don't think he'd last for another 6 years. I think he'll be lucky to last for two. And the big question is really, how does he go? Will he be pushed? Will he resign? Will he be persuaded to step aside? What will happen?
Well, that seems to be the topic du jour. Let's turn to Iran. Israel sending clear messages saying it thinks that a window is closing to attack Iran's nuclear facilities because they're being moved underground. Today, an Israeli official said Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told his cabinet to stop this chit-chat about Iran. But the U.S. Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta also said recently he believes an Israeli attack on Iran is likely in the coming months because of this closing window. So what do you make of this drumbeat about military action against Iran?
I would like to have a war on metaphors, and particularly a war on the metaphor of a window closing. And people are always saying we're at a crossroads, you know, this is, and in fact, international affairs doesn't work like that. There's always a continuum, and things may be easy at some points, harder later on. And perhaps if we negotiated differently or imposed different sanctions a long time ago, Iraq wouldn't have a nuclear program, it would be less far advanced. But right up to the point at which Iraq is preparing to launch a nuclear missile on Israel,
you mean Iran?
Iran, sorry, yes.
It's okay.
Iraq was the last one.
Yeah.
The whole basis of international security is about bargains and deterrence, and so if they build a missile, then they'll have to test the missile, then they'll have to test the warhead, then there's going to be, then eventually you'll have a nuclear-armed Iran. Do you go for a first strike? Do you wait till they try and attack you and then have a devastating counter-strike? There's a whole series of different calculations to make, and I think the idea, simple binary decision, if we don't attack now, we can never attack, is untrue. My own feeling is that an attack isn't that likely, because I think that the Iranian facilities are sufficiently hardened and dispersed. It'd be quite hard to for an attack to be effective, and the risk of counter-strike is quite severe. I also feel that the whole idea that the ballistic missile program is the big problem is a little bit misplaced, that if you really want to deliver a nuclear warhead, you're probably better at doing it by a container ship in a harbour than you are by trying to send it by an accurate intercontinental ballistic missile. So I think to some extent this is being hyped up artificially.
Well, meanwhile, the Obama administration is freezing Iranian assets, restricting the activities of the central bank, the goal of, you know, denying Iran the right to sell its fuel. But people are saying that's hitting the Iranian middle class the hardest, and that's causing resentment against the West. And running parallel to this, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is called on the carpet today by the country's parliament, who want to ask him questions about, charges that he mismanaged the Iranian economy. So where are those two roads headed?
Well, I think the Iranian economy is very mismanaged, and there's no doubt about it. And there's a lot of resentment in Iran about the mullahs and the corruption and so on. I think it would be a mistake to think that the Iranian opposition is dedicated to a nuclear-free Iran and following our security agenda. They're not. And to some extent, the pressure we put on Iran consolidates the leadership in its very intransigent foreign policy stance. I'm in favour of sanctions if they're very short and sharp and targeted and effective for a limited period. I think the danger is we get into a kind of Cuba-style sanctions, which is almost always what happens, where you keep on turning the sanctions up in order not to seem soft, but the result is to entrench the regime and sometimes almost to strengthen it and to allow them to tell a story of paranoia and yeah. Isolation.
Well, we only have a couple minutes yet, and then there's Egypt. You know, in fact, today a meeting between Egyptian officials and Americans over aid to Egypt broke up over the Egyptian judiciary trying these 19 Americans who worked for pro-democracy groups. Americans saying, if you do that, we're going to cut off aid. So that's a spasm there as well. Just about a minute to go, Edward Lucas. Just you sum up the foreign landscape for us. Sorry.
Gosh, well, let me try and do it in 15 seconds. I think there's problems everywhere, but the striking sort of common factor for me is the lack of leadership of the West. You know, I grew up in a world where when Western Europe and North America got together, stuff happened, and the Japanese and the Australians and some other countries would tag along too. And we're now in a different world where, A, I'm not sure the West has quite got the capability that it had, but it doesn't also seem to have the willpower. And I think that's a mistake, and I wonder in a way what would happen if we just stood back and said to the Russians and the Brazilians and the Chinese, okay, you try fixing it. And mm-hmm. I think they'd probably be rather horrified. But I profoundly believe that across the Atlantic, with your country and the EU together, almost a billion people, whether you include all the other allies and hangers-on, that's a for power in the world, and it should be used more effectively.
Edward Lucas of The Economist, his upcoming book, Deception, Spies, Lies, and How Russia Dupes the West. Edward, thanks as always.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.